another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Brantley Smith. Brantley, it's good to be back and to talk about all things money. And I've got two opening stories for this. The first is when my grandfather resigned. I don't think I've told you this. When he resigned, he was resigning under pressure. I think that's the best way to put it. From everything I can tell, he was resigning under pressure. And he says, "I figured out what these guys are doing." And he was referring to the leadership of the cult. He said, "What they're doing is they're setting up these children's things, these children's games and camps and et cetera." And he says, "What I learned was if you can get to the children, you can get to the parents. And if you can get to the parents, you can get to their money." So I left that, and I have to agree with my grandfather's opinion, but it's my opinion, and I'm welcome to that. But I left that, and I went to other mainstream churches, and I went to this really, really large church here in this area. Heard five really good grace-filled sermons. They were talking about how we're no longer under the old covenant of law, and really explained it well. And this is something that I was unfamiliar with in the Branham cult, right? And then on the fifth or sixth time we're there, he says, "Now I'm going to talk about something that's going to make all of you just a little bit uneasy. We're going to talk about tithe." And then he brought us back into the old covenant to get money. And anyway, all this to say, money is an issue in the church that I don't think everybody thinks about it because they're giving the money out, but I don't think anybody really critically thinks about what is happening with their money. And I'm one of the, now that I've left this thing, I'm one of the open minds, man. If I walk into a building and they're asking me for money, I'm going to go get the financial report on my way out. And if they don't have a financial report, they're not getting a dime.
And it's as you're telling these stories, I'm having so many flashbacks of similar situations of preachers bringing up money in a church service, and you can just feel the atmosphere just like just all the air sucked out of the room. This is a fun conversation. It's been on my mind because me and my wife recently made a big purchase, and so we got ourselves a new to us car, and some people will laugh at me because it's a six or seven year old car, but it's new to us. Yeah. And we feel like we're so fancy. We got a 2020 Subaru Forester, and we feel like that we are millionaires right now is how we feel. We have CarPlay in the car, AC that works, somewhat of a leather seat. Like, it's 7 years old, but you know, it's new to us, feels fancy. And we both realized that we feel like this kind of guilt around it, and was ended up talking to another former IHOP KC member about a week after we bought ours, and she was going through the same process. And she was like, "I just feel like I don't deserve nice things." Like, you know, and so it's like this weird relationship with money. I think that's taught to us by the church because we're taught to give so much to the church. I mean, after you pay taxes on your income, and then you add another 10% on top of that in the environments that are kind of legalistic about a tithe. I don't know about you, but I remember sitting down doing my budget many times and trying to do that 10% number. And I'm like, how do people do this? Like, you know, but that's coming from IHOP and having less than $1,000 of income a month.
Yeah. You know, I was of that same mindset. I have nice things, but it has changed over time. Whenever we were in the group, I never ever bought a car that was newer than 10 years old. If it was more than 10 years old, it was too expensive and I wouldn't buy it, because that's not the way John should be. John should be humble and not spend money and give it all to the cult. And that mindset, it sticks with you. After I left the group, I started getting into music a lot more after leaving, because I was playing in one of the churches that I played for, and I was buying some new instruments. And I have nice instruments, but these are all mid-level. There's nothing like, I've got a couple of Epiphones. I could have got the Gibson, which is $5,000, you know, and musiciansfriend.com, one of my $5,000 Gibson guitars is an Epiphone knockoff that's like, I want to say I paid $200 for it. So it's a nice guitar, right? But I was of that mindset. But this mid-level that I have now, I had another set before this, and I was buying cheaper things just because I was indoctrinated, man. You don't buy nice things for yourself because you're not going to need it. You're going home soon. Give us your money instead. And so I'd buy these cheap guitars that wouldn't stay tuned. And some of them, I'd be halfway through a song and it would be out of tune. And I'd be playing, and you've probably seen guys do this, but they'd be picking with the right hand and tuning with the left. I've actually done that in a church service, man. It's pretty bad. And I came to realize, I was talking to another friend who is indoctrinated in the same way, but he came from a hardcore, I guess I won't give the denomination, a mainstream denomination that is fundamentalist leaning. I'll say it like that. And I was telling him about the guitars. And he said, man, just buy a nice one. You buy one nice one, it's going to outlast two or three. And I started shifting my mindset. And anyway, long story short is we were indoctrinated to think that we did not deserve anything. We should give it to the leadership of the cult. And then I'm looking around, the leadership of the cult, man, has children driving Range Rovers while I'm driving a 10-year-old beater.
Yeah.
This is not right.
No, it's not at all. Which we've talked about a whole lot about the theology of not deserving things and what that does to your mind. One of the things that you said was talking about leaving soon. So your wealth here doesn't matter. A big part of IHOP's messaging was buying things that like were eternal. So like that we talk about buying gold refined from the fire from Jesus. And the big one, and I used to preach the sermon at like youth events and stuff that we would do, was about the parable about the 10 virgins from Matthew 25 of you got to get oil before it's too late. And so we saw it was almost like that was a currency. It was a currency in our environment. Intimacy with Jesus was a currency, whatever that means and however you quantify that. But we always lived in this perpetual state of not having enough whenever it came to that aspect of like this eternal currency. And whenever it came to day-to-day needs, the way that we were taught to think was almost like that God was kind of like this divine ATM machine, like this divine exchange of you give $100, you'll get $1,000 back kind of thing is kind of how we were taught things. And I remember the first time that I was like very disappointed by this. And I think that I kind of like rewrote the narrative in my head to like kind of silence the dissonance and like make myself okay with it. But it was my first, summer after my first year in the Bible school at IHOP. And I had moved in the spring semester to a different house and was sharing a room with a guy, almost all IHOPers in that period of time. There were certain IHOP leaders who would buy lots of real estate and they would rent out rooms to the members. And so, you know, we're talking 2008 to 2012 was when I was there. And you could buy houses in Grandview for under $100,000. Like it wasn't like, you know, that was around the stock market crash of 08 and all that kind of stuff. And so you would have one of these leaders who'd own three or four houses, and then they would be getting 5-6 guys in a house at $300 a head. And like, that's how they supported themselves was through that. But so I'd gotten this place, it was $250 a month, but I had to share it with a guy, but we had a master suite with our own bathroom and we had queen size bunk beds. So I thought I was like living high. We even like drilled a end table, like a side table to the upside down to the ceiling. I was on the top bunk so that I had a little end table up top, and we thought we were cool. And we were all in the music school together, so we were always playing music in the house and people were always coming over and playing music with us. It was actually really fun. And that's some stuff that, you know, we don't talk about. I mean, not that we want to glorify that necessarily, but being in a cult's fun. It is at times. Like there's times like I don't get to go walk into my living room and play with 10 musicians anymore every day. Like that's not a thing. But I remember I started working for the teen camp after school was out that summer, and I still had to pay my rent every month. In my first year, I'd raised support, and that had lasted almost the full school year, I think that people still supported me. The church I grew up in was very involved in the Brownsville revival stuff and sent a bunch of people to that ministry school and supported them there. So there was kind of a little bit of a precedent that made it a little bit easier for me to get support from the church and people in the church. And I think, if I remember right, I think I had raised like maybe $600 to $800 a month or something like that. And my parents were paying my car payment, insurance, and my cell phone. And so I had to pay $250 for my rent, and everything else was just eating and surviving. And so I was able to live off of it. But that summer I went to work for the teen camp, and I think I made $1,000 to work for them all summer. I think it was like 12 weeks, 24/7. And I think they paid me $1,000 at the end of the summer, which I thought was big money, because I don't think I'd ever had $1,000 in my bank account at one time. But during that time, because we didn't get paid till the end of summer and my support was dropping off, I wasn't able to pay my rent. And I kind of felt bad, because the guy who owned my house, he didn't own a bunch of houses. He just had the people there, and he was raising support. And so I was $500 behind on rent just because I didn't have any money. I think it was like $125 or something like that in my bank account. And which I just didn't give him, because I was like, I ain't got the 500. Like, I got to eat, got to live off this. And I was sitting in a service during the teen camp stuff, and they give this big call of like, I can't even remember what the cause was for. Maybe it was for the camp. Maybe I was giving money to the camp that was paying me. I don't know. That's kind of how bait and switches. But I remember very clearly feeling like I had to give $100. And if I gave $100, that everything was going to be okay and I would be taken care of, kind of thing. And because, you know, God never leaves the righteous forsaken or his seed begging for bread. Like, that's where I was, you know. Like, I mean, I was like, so internalized this. And so I give my $100. I got my, you know, $20 or whatever to my name. And long story short, I still owe that guy $500 to this day. I never got to pay him back. And I probably should send him some money sometime. Hey, remember this? So that was weird. But I ended up getting a new house with some counselors that I worked with at the teen camp at the end of summer. And I think that's the way that I saw God's provision working, was that we were able to get a different house, so I wasn't homeless. And so you rationalize those things and jump through the hoops. And like, I can't imagine asking a 18-year-old, is how old I would have been at that time, with $125 in his bank account, asking him to give you 100 of his last 125. Like, that's wrong to me.
It's funny to me how much it's changed over the decades. My other grandfather was in the cult during the latter rain years, and he had ministers. They were all talking about how we're going to be raptured tomorrow, you know, that you don't need the things of today because we won't be here tomorrow, that kind of thing. Well, the preacher, I've told this story before on the podcast, the preacher got into this kick talking about how you don't need all of the things you have today. The Bible says, give it to the poor. And my grandfather walked up to him after church and said, man, if I give all my money to the poor, then I become the poor. And how does that work, right? And by poor, he meant give it into the offering plate and let me give it to the poor, because you can trust me, you know. That's how it works. And then after this, you know, the prosperity gospel was birthed, and give it to me and then God will repay you, because no longer was there a immediate imminent rapture kind of theology. That kind of went away when Branham died, and it just turned into give me your money and I will give it to God and God will bless you and you can trust me, this will happen. Well, people do it and they still continue to do it, and they never get like my grandfather. They become the poor. I know people that are in that gospel, and it's just quote unquote gospel, I should say, and it's just unbelievable. But money, in both cases, money is treated more of a practical necessity. You have money and you should only buy the practical things, because give all your money to God. And by God, I mean give it to the leadership. I did the math one day. I was sitting in church. This was after I left the cult and I was allowed to critically think. I was in a church, not the big one, but just a smaller one, very small church that was preaching the tithe doctrine, and I did the math. Usually you give about 10%, and some of them will even tell you, you must give 10%, but 10 people makes a salary, man. And if you're in a small building that's paid for, only thing you got to pay for is the lights, the electricity, the water, that kind of thing. I know what those add up to. I pay for them at my house, right? So it's not that much money. Well, you get 100 people, you've got 10 salaries. Does the minister really need 10 salaries? And you can argue, yes, but maybe he gives money to the poor, but where's the accounting of this? I'm okay with this, man, if you show me the books and show me which poor got it, right? But if it's going to your Land Rover, no, man, I'm not going to pay for you to have a Land Rover while I'm driving a 10-year-old beater, which is the reason why I chose actually the last vehicle I bought, which was, gosh, it might have been 10 years ago now, but I did buy a new vehicle for the first time ever after leaving the cult, and I felt so guilty about buying that new vehicle. I still, to this day, I'm like, man, I shouldn't have done that, and I don't know that I will buy another new one after that, but it plays with your mind when you're in this type of group.
Yeah, and it's crazy to see those churches that I was listening to. A survivor of a spiritual abuse environment, a religiously abusive environment, this week on a podcast, and they were talking about the pastor. They were on staff at a church, and they were talking about how the pastor would check the giving records. And in this particular story, what had happened was the pastor had called this lady after he had heard that she had not been, he'd saw the giving records and saw that she had not given in the past 2 months. And he picks up the phone and calls her and says, "The Holy Spirit told me that you're having financial trouble." It's like, and she was sharing this story. She's like, did he not realize that I knew that he looked at the giving records? But she talked about that dynamic that happens. I think that both of us can relate to, of you kind of have this split of your rational mind tells you he looked at the sheet of paper and he knows, but there's still that part of you that thinks that they're a prophet or something, that there's some kind of mystical power there. Maybe they're right. And, you know, but that's like, I've seen that in so many environments, and I've seen that used as a way of prioritizing resource in a sense, based on how much someone gives is how much time and energy they get from the leaders in the community, which I think Jesus had very particular stories about that, and seats of preference. And, you know, I think that's pretty easy to show how that's harmful in scripture. So these guys that they, I'm glad to know that I'm not the only one that's done the 10% math. Because as you're saying, I've done that same thing before in backroom conversations in local churches. Like, they have language for that. They call it giving units is what it is. And like, a family is a giving unit, and they know how many giving units they need giving regularly to meet their budget, which is just, it's crazy. But I've looked at it the same way as you do. I'm like, if you need 10 people to pay a salary, like, that's a full-time income. And to be fair, it's going to be an average of your congregation's income. Like, you're going to be sitting in the middle. You have 10% of the high earner, 10% of the low earner. Like, it's going to average out. So like, how we get so far from the mark, I'm not quite sure. It's the poverty mindset does a number on you. It does.
Yeah. I was talking with Jenny about Youth with a Mission, and she was talking about how while she was in this, she was getting the martyr complex, and her martyr complex was basically the physical condition she was in. But I got to thinking about it, that martyr complex goes far beyond just your physical being. It goes to your financial being. You will martyr your own money, basically. I have friends, and I would say that they're not in a cult. They go to another really large church around this area. And if you did the 10 people math on that building, man, I can't tell you how many salaries are flowing in that. The big auditorium, stadium seating. You do the math on that, and there's quite a bit of money flowing through that place. Yet, whenever there's a missionary trip, the missionaries are contributing financially towards their mission. And I'm sitting there thinking, now, wait a minute. If you've got that much money flowing through this building, why on earth do you need these poor people to pay for their mission? And then Jenny was talking about in Youth with a Mission, it's the same way. The children have to pay gosh, I think she said it was like $10,000, if I remember right, to join this mission. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. With that much money flowing through some of these organizations, why do you need to do this? And it really comes back to what she said about martyring complex. You will martyr your pocketbook to join this cult, and you think that you're doing it for God and that God cares about dollar bills. But I don't read that in the Bible. I don't read anywhere where God really cares about your money. That's just, it's turned into this modern thing. And I think that's part of the revival culture.
We had so much loaded language around, this is the big word, wasting our lives at the feet of Jesus is what it was. And that applied to everything. And the story that they would pull from for that was whenever the perfume was poured over Jesus, and why this waste, why this big waste. And that's part of what drew us into the prayer movement. We weren't thinking purely financial whenever we talked about it, but it was kind of like that martyr complex thing, of the phrase that me and a friend were tossed around lately that was used as laid down lovers. Like that's like language that would be used. And then you looked at other things, which was a big message at IHOP, that one thing is needed. We had the one thing internship, the one thing conferences, and that was all Psalm, what was it, 24, 27, 4 or something like that, of one thing I've desired. To the Lord, that will I seek, to live in his house all the days of my life and to gaze upon his beauty. And I probably butchered that, but it's the idea that you sit in the prayer room for the rest of your life. That's the one thing that's needed. And so like you end up trading away all this financial potential even too. Like that's one of the things that people don't look at as the cost of being a part of these movements is... Which our engagement level, I guess, was a lot different than a local church, being this parachurch ministry, and we had a missions base. I mean, we practically had a non-fenced-in commune that stretched across South Kansas City is kind of how it was. We had houses all over neighborhoods and all this kind of thing. But there were people, whenever Mike Bickle got exposed with the allegations of CSA in October 23, there were families that wanted to leave immediately, but couldn't because they were so dependent on the system. They were hardly making any money. They were probably like my summer camp pay. They were probably getting $1,000 a month or something, $1,200 a month. And maybe their spouse was getting that too. And I don't know if y'all have looked at rent prices lately, but you know, $2,400 a month in a city in the United States, like you may have $1,000 left over to live off of after you pay a rent or something. But these people had no work experience outside of this. So you would go to one of these one thing conferences as a teenager, young adult in college, you would hear Mike give this message. And then you would hear someone like Alan Hood say, you know, that you don't need to go to real university, that you need to invest in eternity and come get the education that matters and be heavenly minded so you can be earthly good. Like you have all those cliches, you know, we talk about those promos all the time, how it sucked us in, like they were expert marketers. But you do that. Like me, I walk in at 17. Like if I would have stayed there for longer, like some of these other people, they stayed there for a decade and had 15 kids, because that's what IHOPers do. They have lots of kids and they have no real resume like to pull back and fall on. And so whenever they're trying to step outside that world, like the best you have is maybe if you were involved in media. We've seen people like who are involved in the media department be able to break out and go like in the local film industry in Kansas City and different places with like audio work and video work. And you see some people, there's one friend that I have who's become very successful at doing like cinematic movie music stuff and commercial music. And so some of them were able to take some of that invested skill and effort that they did during their time there and turn it into something. But the Annas is what we called them in the House of Prayer, those who were called to be intercessory missionaries, which was a thing that Mike Bickle totally made up. Those who were called to do that and stay in the house of the Lord all their life, like all they did was sit in that seat because they were an Anna and it was the one thing that they were supposed to do, to be a Mary instead of a Martha. There's so much loaded language that when those people step away, like it's, you can't, even if you want to, you can't, because you can't find a way to survive. And it always gets turned back on those individuals somehow. As you were talking earlier, that was the last thing I was jotting down there was one of the verses that was weaponized a lot is where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. And that was usually a whole lot had to do with money, is what that had to do, and how you don't need to be attached to money. And I didn't know that we were Stoics, but apparently, you know, we're supposed to get rid of our attachments.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You're talking about where your treasure is. I can't tell you how many sermons that I heard with that phrase in it. And we had... It wasn't unique to us. I've studied multiple cults that had the same type of mentality, but there's this idea that you can achieve spiritual perfection. And as far back as I can trace it all the way back to Gnosticism. The Gnostics believed that they could achieve the spiritual perfection through the divine mysteries or whatever it is they said they had. But as it relates to the financials, we almost became... I don't know what the word is. There's this fine line between faith and instability. You basically walk down this line, and if you could martyr your pocketbook, you were more spiritually mature than the next guy. And I look back at some of the people, man, I know people that made really, really good money. I don't know where all their money went, but they lived cheaper than I did, and I live pretty cheap on a tight budget. When we got married, I worked at a hardware store, my wife worked at Dairy Queen, and she made more money than me, which is it's a kind of funny story. And we lived pretty poor. I mean, we had to. I know rich people who lived poorer than us while we were in that mindset, because they're martyring their pocketbooks. And I look back, and it's just, you know, it's one thing to conserve money, and I'm all for being conservative with regards to your budget, because you need a nest egg for when you retire, this kind of thing. But it goes beyond that. People are martyring them, sometimes their health. Sometimes they won't eat right because they're not spending enough money. Sometimes they might really, really need that one tool or gadget or whatever, and they'll make do and just suffer through with it. And they're suffering for no reason. So they're causing themselves to be martyred in ways beyond the pocketbook, but solely because of the pocketbook. So this mentality, and while you're watching people suffer like this, you're watching the ministers or the elders, the leadership, people are giving them not only money, but whatever they need. If they need a Makita drill, they're going to go buy the best drill that they can possibly get them, while they themselves will use the Walmart cheap tools, you know. Yeah. I grew up with people like that. Again, not everybody's like that, but when you're preaching that type of martyr mentality, the people who are more spiritually in tune with what you're saying, they're going to try to go above and beyond what you say. And so they martyr themselves even further.
Yeah, food is such a funny thing, which I hadn't connected that to money, but it really is a big thing. I remember hearing stories before. I had people almost warn me, I feel like it's coming to mind, of my friends who went to Brownsville, who were older than me, Revival School of Ministry, that talked about not living off ramen, like don't eat ramen every day or it's bad for you, kind of thing. And I really did have friends who did that and got sick and had to go to the hospital because they ate ramen like every day, 30 days straight, kind of thing. And it was because they had no money is what it was. And I remember it brought back a memory of whenever I was working for the internship during my last year or so there. Part of our compensation package. So they gave us housing is what I got. I got a free place to live, but I had to live with the interns. And so, but I had my own bedroom. And And then they gave us three meals a week in the cafeteria. So the interns did get fed 3 days, three times a day, except on Tuesdays, because that was fasting days, but they'd put out PB&Js and stuff for the ones who couldn't fast is what it was, but they wouldn't cook on Tuesdays. And so I could go in and get lunch three times a week or whatever, but we would save those and ration those because we didn't know day to day, like what things would look like. So we rationed those the three we got a week. But I remember there being a period where, man, this is hard because I hadn't thought about this in a long time, is I went on a fast one time, and I think that one of the subconscious motivations of that was I didn't have money was part of the reason why I fasted. And I'd went on a smoothie fast, though, is what it was. I told myself I was going to get, I bought a jar of peanut butter and a thing of honey, and I think some like frozen fruit or something like that, like a big old, went to one of our, somebody always had a Sam's Club membership around or something that their parent paid for or something, and went and bought one of those like massive bulk size bags of fruit. And I had a little blender, and I would throw peanut butter in there. I'd throw honey and, you know, top it off with water probably is what it was in the fruit, and would blend that up and drink one of those a day. And that was like, in my mind, I was doing a Daniel fast because I wasn't eating meat is what it was, a smoothie fast, I guess. And I remember I did that for like a little over a week or so, just eating, drinking those smoothies. I wasn't a good faster, but, and then there was also that the other big time during the week, I wish I could remember what days of the week it was, because used to, that was like ingrained in my head. We had our Panera Bread drop-offs, both at the prayer room, the main missions base, and then at IHOP U, which was up the interstate, just an exit. But different days of the week, a different Panera branch would bring their stale leftover bread that they couldn't sell but was still good, and would drop it off at the prayer room. And man, I tell you, like, people would, there's a patio outside of the prayer room next to the coffee shop and the bookstore, and they had maybe like 6-8 cafe tables or something like that out there where people could sit. And people would like just lurch out there, like just like lurking, waiting for, it was a big garbage bag is what it was too. Like it was a big clear bag that the stuff was put in, and they would drop it on the sidewalk. It's crazy to think about. It sounds third world, doesn't it? And everybody would just like collapse on it because everybody wanted to get the good stuff first, kind of thing. Like if you got there after the thing was, you know, parted, it was like all the crappy stuff that was left. If you wanted like a cheese bagel or something like that, you better get there right away. Like that stuff went quick. And then we also had, and I remember I didn't know what it was for like the first year that I was at IHOP, because there was so much shame around this subject, I think, because the other thing that was talked against was like government support and assistance. So like nobody was on SNAP, nobody was using Medicaid or anything like that for being low income. Thankfully, during that time, that would have been like around the time when Obamacare was passed. And so we were able to stay on our parents' insurance, or else none of us would have had any kind of health care either. But they had, every week they would send out these emails, and they would talk about manna for you is what it was called. I just couldn't figure out what it was for the longest time, until after that first summer and I lost my house and I moved in with those guys after summer camp. And I realized that they had been going, and we started going at that time, because all of us were broke. It was a food pantry set up, and it was, I'll tell you who it was ran by. It was ran by Corey Asbury's parents is who it was. It was his mother and father, and they ran it out of their garage for the longest time. I think they ended up moving at some point later. But they just had these big shelves around their garage, and they would put food in there, and they had big deep freezers, and you never knew what you were going to get or walk away with. But it wasn't a food pantry for the people in the community in need. It was a food pantry for the members is what it was, which is just crazy. It's crazy to me that you would think at that point somebody would have enough sense to assess the situation and say something's not okay if we're having to do a food pantry for our people.
Yeah, it's just not right. There's not many people besides me that can say that they remember Beanie Weenies and Kool-Aid was a good meal. Canned roast beef was a better meal. I remember, man, when we'd open up the canned roast beef, we were in heaven. But I look back at those times, and so I know a minister, won't give names, but I know a minister who every time he went out to eat, and he would pick a different family every Sunday, he'd go out to eat with people, and he would pay for the whole table's meal. And whenever we went, I was thinking, man, he is such a man of God. And now looking back, thinking through the tithe and doing that 10-person math, you know, 10 people is a whole salary, I'm like, good Lord, they're paying for their meal. They just don't know they're paying for their meal. But it looks like he's the hero. And that's really, it turns into a hero complex. After leaving, I started thinking about that. When I did the 10-person math in my head and just suddenly realized, wait a minute, we're in the Matrix and they're stealing our money. I'd taken the pill, right? I went back and I read the passages from the Old Testament that talked about tithe. Because they're always preaching tithe, and even though we're supposed to be under the new covenant, with regards to money, we're going to go back to the old covenant, because that's the way it works, my brother. I started reading through that, and there was never a give me tithe of your money kind of thing. It was always give me your goats. And I started laughing in the middle of service, because I was thinking, I wonder what this guy would do if I brought him a goat. And I went beyond that. You know, I'm reading, and the way that the Jewish system worked, it was almost like a banking system. It was more for reserve, I think, than it was, God doesn't care about the goats, man. That's just, if you think God is caring that you're giving the priest a goat, I think you're looking at religion altogether wrong. But it was more for, they would have, on the seventh day, they would not work. They would not go, you know, take care of the livestock, etc. There's a day of rest, right? Well, during the day of rest, the priests would take the not only the goats, but the wine or whatever they had stored up. And then every seventh week, they did it every seventh year. Then there was the year of the Jubilee. Every, 49th year, I think it was, two whole years of rest, partying, relaxation, and I mean, they were breaking out the good wine during that. And I got to thinking, there was never a case where a minister was asking for tithe, where he gave it back, in which he did not come out to look like a hero when he gave it back. It was always that he was doing it something for it, like the guy who's taking people out to eat. And then it becomes more about the priest than it does about God, or even about tithe, right? It's more about making that person a hero. But then if you continue reading the tithe passages, at the end, he gave everything back to the people who had given it to him, except for he kept, I think it was like 10% he kept to live out the rest of his life. There was never a case where I've paid tithe and they actually gave me money back. Now, they will count on me to go get some back from the government back whenever the government gave you a good, healthy IRS tax benefit. But it was never done in the way of the tithing system. What it was, they were tricking the people. They would say, we're going to follow the new covenant except for regards with money. With regards for money, we're going to follow the old covenant, but just the part that benefits me as the priest.
Yeah, I think whenever we look at Sabbath and how all those things were done, like it's so, I can't help but think that it's a better way of living, like to have those times of rest and have plans in place to be able to do those things. Like I don't know anybody in America that doesn't have to work 40 hours a week to live. Like, I mean, sure, like low income on disability or something like that. I couldn't imagine. I mean, I guess the closest thing we have is like the pandemic to a 2-year jubilee of not doing anything. I guess that was the closest thing we'll have in our lifetime to that. But I had the thought too, kind of back to what I was talking about earlier. I'm just having all these memories flood back, if that's okay. So I'm kind of just shooting from the hip on these. But I remember I used to do worship leading sets at Hope City, which was the inner city ministry in Kansas City. It was ran by Mike's sister, Lisa Bickle. And they would shuttle us down there to go help staff the prayer room and stuff. But I remember people tagging along with us and going with us and playing with us intentionally because they knew it was like that they were doing the soup kitchen that day. And that we were going down there supposedly to do ministry to the inner city community. And we're all hoping that we can snag a meal when we go down there. Like I remember that being common conversations. And I remember what my biggest treat was, like my splurge that I would do. And I probably did it once a week or so. It was my guilty pleasure, I guess, and people will laugh, but we had the coffee shop that was right next to the prayer room, and they sold food and stuff too. But one of the things that they sold, and they sold them at cost. I knew that because the operations manager was my roommate at one point. So they sold them at cost. They didn't make any money off of them, but they had Einstein bagels is what it was. And it was about $2 to get one. And I remember many times looking at my bank account and seeing I had like $6 or $8 in my bank account. And it usually happened on fasting days. It's usually when it happens is I'm sitting at the prayer room at 8 o'clock at night and I've not ate anything. And I'm like, I can't make it till midnight. Like I'm supposed to be in here till midnight. And and higher ground's about to close. So you'd sneak over there and grab a bagel. And I think with like cream cheese and stuff, it was like $2.25, $2.50, something like that. And that was like my biggest treat. But I remember feeling guilty about that. And that's what's insanity. Like we had these little, like we knew every spot in, you know, in the 10 mile radius of where we could get a cheap meal. We knew on, Mondays or Tuesdays, CC's Pizza used to do the buffet for like $3.99 or whatever. And we all thought we were living high. Whenever we would do that, we would eat way too many brownies from CC's Pizza. There was a little Asian place that had a Chinese place that had, it's called Peking Express. And we all, they would like load you up with a styrofoam box full of food. And it was like $5. And that was any day. So like whenever you had a lot of money, that's what we would do. But it was very rare. Like, you know, we would hear stories of people going to the big buffets in Kansas City, the Brazilian steakhouses, like all these things, man. We were just like, man, maybe for our birthday, maybe for something special, you know? And, it very rarely happened. I could think maybe like three times, like my whole time there that we like went to somewhere like that, went to like this big Italian buffet, and I never made it to a Brazilian steakhouse, but, yeah, man, it's so dystopian to like look back on and think that that's how I used to live, and that now it's still impacting me whenever I think about buying a car. Is like, and I've even been thinking about that like lately too, with like yesterday I was about my clothing that I wear. I always choose simple just because it's like one of them like decisions I don't have to make. 9 times out of 10 when you see me, I'm going to be wearing a black t-shirt of some sort and blue jeans. Like that's my daily uniform. And, but I was like, I'm tired of buying Old Navy t-shirts that like get holes in them after a year. Like, yeah. What can I do? You know? And I did splurge and get this Carhartt t-shirt at one point. And I was having a little conversation with Gemini on my phone. And I was like, how could I like get better quality, longer lasting t-shirts? And it was like, you need to buy more Carhartt t-shirts. And I'm like, okay. And so I'm going to have to start buying $30 t-shirts instead of $10 t-shirts and feel okay about that because it's not as wasteful, you know? You know, it's just crazy, like the subtle ways that it shapes you. And me and my friends have conversations about it all the time. Like, you know, we feel like we're walking in a totally different world from everyone else, but still to this day. And it's been almost 15 years since I left. So
exactly. I'm embarrassed to say we were married, and this continued after I had left the cult. Even you're in that mentality where you just don't spend money. And the clothing that we bought, we'd go to consignment shops or Goodwill or places like this, right? And I remember the moment that it changed. I work in IT, so we made good money. It's not that I couldn't afford it. It's that we had that mentality. I remember I was standing there when it finally clicked that this is wrong. I'm standing there and this really, really poor family walked in. You could tell that they just didn't have anything. And here I am making good IT money in a consignment shop and watching this poor family. I shouldn't be buying those things. That I should leave the good things that I want for the families that need it. But we were in that mentality, and you just stay in that mentality. It's just so weird. You were talking about all the pizzas, and I remember those locations. I spent a lot of time in Kansas too, so I remember those places. That we went to a Pizza Hut buffet, however, as a church group. I'll never forget it. It was kind of a funny thing. One of the guys, he was flirting with a girl, and she had left her keys on the table, and he picked it up, and she had pepper spray. And he says, oh, I wonder what that smells like. And he does this, but he does it away from his face, but just a squirt of it. And we learned that day you can empty a building with one squirt of pepper spray.
Oh my gosh.
they had to throw the food out. I mean, it was a big deal. But and that's a weird side story, but it relates in that we weren't raised to be normal. That's really the bottom line. Normal people don't do stupid stuff like that, but we weren't raised to be normal. And in the way that we were raised to have this martyrdom complex, we need to forfeit everything we have so the priest can have all of the good stuff. It also comes, when you add the groupthink element, it becomes even worse because you're suffering. And if you see somebody else who's not, you're going to talk about them. And then you're going to talk to somebody else who's also going to talk about them. And eventually, they're going to hear that they're being talked about. And then they're going to suffer too because everybody else is suffering. Why shouldn't I? So it turns into this groupthink thing where you're actually watching all of the people around you. And the focus is just so much in the wrong place. The focus is on the people, not in God. And so the whole system trains people not only to martyr themselves, but to cause other people who might otherwise have a normal, healthy life, it causes them to be drugged down with them.
Yeah, it caused also, I see about the support raising element of it, as you were talking about that, is it caused a resentment towards certain people as well, because there were certain people in the community who were connected and maybe not like on staff or something like that, may have lived in one of the IHOP houses, and they were like a realtor or had a real job of some sort to where they made money. And I remember hearing those people complain so much because all the time people were handing them support raising letters is what it was, because they had a real job and real money. And so since they were in the, also another example of loaded language, because they were in the marketplace, you know, they felt like that they were called to the, that God must be calling them to support intercessory missionaries and, to be a Cyrus of sorts, to help fund the prayer movement. And that put strain on relationships. And I remember coming back home for a visit, and a family that I had, I may have shared this story before, I can't remember, but a family that their kids had gone to Brownsville. And so that they had kind of gone through, I think they had two of their three boys had gone to Brownsville School of Ministry. And they had gone on to do other successful things after that. So they kind of broke that cycle a little bit. At least one of them did. And I had sent them support raising letters and asked them for money and stuff. And I remember them being super generous whenever I was around and present. They weren't people who were sending me checks or anything like that when I was in Kansas City. But whenever I came to town to visit, like, they were always buying me food, slipping me money, those kind of things, just trying to like look out for me in a sense, I think. And I remember this one time that they had bought a car maybe about 2-3 hours away from where we were. And they asked me if I would go with them so that I could drive back one of the vehicles. And so they had me in the car stuck for 2 hours, and they start asking questions about the prophetic history and what it meant and all these things. And, you know, and I'd gone to them asking for money, like through support letters and stuff. And I just remember, like, I remember the feeling of dissonance, because I remember thinking, they just don't understand. Like, they don't understand the prophetic promises. They don't understand what God's doing in the earth. They don't, you know. And but there was also a side of me that was like, man, I really respect these people. Like, could they be right? Like, am I deceived? It wasn't enough to shake me out then. But that was one of those, you know, those moments that money, I think, impacted those relationships in a sense. And I'm grateful for people like that, though, who had enough sense and enough boldness, for lack of a better term, to be able to have those conversations with me, because I don't think that I would have ended up in the place that I was to be able to walk away from it without those, that consistent, to borrow Christian language again, seed planting that would happen over the years. And thankfully I had a little prophetic narrative around me leaving. And I think that allowed me to step away as well. So, yeah, stuff goes deep, man.
One thing I've wondered is if IHOP KC had this kind of dynamic. We had the martyr complex, and the rank and file members, they're by and large martyring themselves in ways that I've described already. But within the cult structure, there was like this class system. Mm-hmm. It was odd to me that I was in the rank and file class because of who my dad was and his relationship to the leadership. But I clearly remember there was a class system. The ones at the very bottom, they martyr themselves a lot. They, even the people who were wealthy, they didn't have a lot. But usually, the more wealthy were in another tier. So while you're in that tier, you didn't have to martyr yourself as much. And they did have nice cars. They did have nice things. And the people really didn't talk about them because they were in a separate class. And the class usually, I mean, when it comes right down to it, it probably was because they had money, but they usually had some sort of a connection to the leadership that was beyond what the average person had. And so you looked at them differently. And so within the cult, there was a class system, but it defied all of the laws of what a class system would look like because it wasn't really based on whether you had money or not. You just martyred yourself further if you were in that. Did IHOP KC have anything like this?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it had to do with the proximity to the gatekeepers, for lack of a better term, like the proximity to Mike Bickle or whoever it was, that the people that we saw in that class kind of structure would have been like those B, C level leaders that were underneath. And they were the ones who that I kind of looked at. I remember looking at jealously, and I think a lot of people did, because nobody flaunted money around IHOP. I mean, Mike, you know, he drove his old beater Honda and his same outfit every day, and, you know, had this whole like false humility thing, allegedly false humility. Can I say that? I don't know if I can say that. Had this whole humility thing that he had. It was part of his shtick, that he was living this simple life. And it's to look back on it now, it's just it's funny, because you can poke holes in it. I think listening to you talk about people walking up and handing gifts at Christmas time and different things like that has helped me kind of like see those things in our own environment. And one of those things was Mike would always, he would always take a sabbatical at the beginning of every year. He would disappear for a month. Every January he would go to Florida, and it was like him going up the mountain for the year after we had just done the One Thing conference. And so it was his time, and he would always come back after he came back with some kind of big message, some kind of big idea for the year. But so like most of us could not do that. Like we couldn't even take a weekend vacation, a day trip. There's parts of Kansas City. I lived there for almost five years. And there's parts of the city I've still not seen. We ran stay put. We didn't have any money. We couldn't drive anywhere. I had one of the few vehicles, and so like I passed around my vehicle, and that bit me in the rear a couple times. But yeah, so the people who got to travel, and that was B and C tier leaders, in the IHOP U teachers, or the directors of certain ministries and internships and such. You would see some of those guys would get to, and it's usually guys, would get to travel on the weekends and go places. They would get to travel overseas and do conferences. And then there were certain, I guess, folks like me who were in proximity to those people who were kind of like their, I guess if you come from certain Pentecostal circles, I think the equivalent would be like an armor bearer. If people are familiar with that, like, I don't want to call them bootlickers. I feel like that's a little bit too derogatory, but they were the people who were attached at their hip, but they got to go places with them. That's kind of how it was. It was like the opportunities and how much you got to get outside the community, I guess, is kind of a level of trust that you're able to leave, even though there's nobody like forcibly holding you there. But I guess financially we were held there. That's the invisible fence.
Yeah, it's really sad, because there's so many aspects of life that goes far beyond the church and far beyond the present tense that it hinders. How old was I? I was 47 years old whenever I first realized that, wait a minute, the rapture's not going to happen in any minute like they were saying, and I have $0 in retirement, $0.
Yeah.
And I started doing the math, and even still today, I do the math like once a month or something. There's no way I'll ever get enough money to retire. And I gave so much money. I could have retired on the tithe money I gave, man. Yep. I wish I'd have done the 10% math back when I was 16, not when I was in my mid 40s. But retirement's just one aspect. You have people who are martyring themselves while also paying tuition. And by paying tuition, I mean they get a school loan to pay their tuition and later have to pay the school loan back. Well, think about all of the money that they gave the church that they could have paid instead of taking out the loan. Now they're paying the interest on all of this. And that's just, I mean, those are just two examples, but think of all of the many examples where, because I hate to say, in my opinion, they're robbing people of money.
Yeah.
If that's true, if they are stealing money, which is my opinion, well, think of the ways that they're stealing that goes far beyond just the tithe basket, man. It ruins every aspect of your life, especially as you get older.
Yeah, as you're saying that, I all of a sudden had another memory come. I didn't find myself in this situation, thankfully, because I did have a scholarship to IHOPU, whatever that means. So I didn't have to pay tuition, but it was not uncommon for classmates or interns to be like asking people, like other community members, being like, hey, like I need to have my tuition paid by this date. I got to have $1,200 or I got to have, you know, $500 for this month's payment or whatever it was. Which to me is just crazy. Like that one that you're paying to be forced labor is, is like one thing that just, messes with you. But, it really is robbery. And I know that there was also like this ostracizing of people who had to work a job. And there was, you know, people in the community knew who IHOP was vaguely, and they just knew that we were all weird and really exuberant. And so that there were some places that just wouldn't hire IHOPers. And there were some places that loved to hire IHOPers, like Starbucks loved to hire the eager, starry-eyed IHOPers. And they saved a lot of people, Starbucks did, from the grasp of IHOP. I remember friends being almost like admonished, or not admonished, what's the word I'm looking for? Like rebuked? No, that might be too strong of a word, but like scolded maybe might be a better word for going out and getting outside work to support themselves.
In the South, we called it, we got a tongue lashing.
A tongue lashing, there you go. Bless his heart. And so they would go and try to get jobs. But the thing was, our schedules were so rigorous. And whenever you would go and ask a leader, like, hey, can I switch my prayer room hours from this time to this time so that I can work? A lot of times that was met with a no. And I don't think that we realized how, I think it didn't set right with us, like when things like that would happen, or some people would work in restaurants, you know, and so we always had our evening services on the weekends, and that's a high time for restaurant people. And, they didn't want them missing the services. Like they had to be there every Friday, Saturday night. And it's like, that's their biggest income times. And so, that made it really hard. And I've heard a lot of people express, you know, harm and hurt over that aspect of, you know, I can't imagine, even working like 15 hours a week, 20 hours a week outside of IHOP on top of everything else that I was doing. I was very grateful that I'd say 80% of my time there, it was kind of a little local church that me and my friends went to that they would pay us to come. I think I've talked about that before. They'd pay us to come lead worship for them. They'd pay me $100 a Sunday, and they would pay my friends, anybody would come with me, $50. And there are people that came and played with me for $50 who are decently known music producers now, we'll say, in the Christian circles. And that's how little money we all had. This guy had an album that was going like crazy, in Christian circles. I don't want to out him, so I'm not going to name it, but songs that like a lot of people in charismatic stuff would know, they would know this stuff. And it's a lot of people's favorite worship album. This one album I'm thinking about that had just come out. And the guy was driving 30 minutes with me to go play at a church for $50 a Sunday. And he's having international influence in a sense. Yeah, it's a different world. It's almost like slavery.
It is. And you know, I'm sitting here thinking, how do you wrap this up? I don't know that we've even gotten anywhere. We've complained for an entire hour. And the bottom line is, it's making me decide that maybe I need a second job. You've changed my life in the course of this podcast. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.